Alright, let's keep rolling on. Up next we've got Miss Emily Gardner here. She's a physical therapist at Memorial Hermann Ironman Sports Medicine Institute at Ware. She's one of the site coordinators for clinical education. Interested in doing working with a young athlete, biomechanical movement analysis. And I've got down that you work with CTS soccer. Happy to have you here. Your presentation.
Alright. Can you hear me?
Yes.
All right. So, as Justin said, I work over at our Shepherd at Memorial Hermann Shepherd Square Clinic. In my past, I also started my practice up in the Fort Worth area, working in pediatric sports medicine for a few years. And then when we moved down here from my husband's job, that's when I started working with Memorial Hermann in their Ironman Institute. So that's a little bit of my background and sort of the context in which I'm talking to you all about pediatric athletes. So, objectives today is to understand who the youth athlete is. Who are these people who fall into this pediatric bucket? We also want to appreciate some of their unique anatomy and physiology. How are they different? How are they going to be different from your 18-year-old? And how is the 12-year-old going to be a little bit different? And then also we'll talk about some of the common diagnoses that you're going to see in this population and some treatment strategies. All right, so this chart just gives sort of a time spectrum of the changes that you're going to see from pediatric, which is maybe like 8, 9, 10 years old, through the adolescent phase, which is 11 to 15, depending upon gender and just genetics, and then the adult, which is likely going to be 17 and onward. So keep those general time frames in mind with the athletes that you're treating. If someone is 12, 13, they could be presenting like a pediatric patient, and they could also, depending upon the maturity level, be presenting like an 18-year-old, like a full adult. And they're going to have very specific differences depending upon where they fall on that spectrum. So some of these differences is going to be some of the skeletal differences you're going to see is that pediatric athletes have open growth plates, which is a point of weakness. That's going to be a likely site of fracture or avulsion. We're going to get into that with some of the diagnoses that you'll see. When they're adolescents, they hit a growth spurt, their bones grow very quickly, and their muscles are stretched tight on top of it. So that's why all of a sudden kids are really loose. They're made of rubber bands and pillows. And then when you're an adult, you're very tight. And that's why your 18-year-old male athlete tends to have really tight hamstrings, is because bone growth happens very quickly and then the muscles are stretched on top of it. Secondly, are some of the hormonal changes that you'll see. So your pediatric athlete has very low levels of testosterone and estrogen, and that changes during puberty and maturation to then present as an adult. So that's something to keep in mind when you're working with someone who likely is really more of a pediatric athlete, though they be 12 or 13, their potential for muscular hypertrophy is very low. Your pediatric patients and athletes, it's best to work with them on technique. Get their squat technique really great. Have them a solid push-up, get good core stability, work on technique, agility. These are things that are going to carry through as they age, so that then when they actually do go through puberty and can utilize the testosterone and estrogen that's coursing through their system, then they're going to have great technique already. You're not going to have to spend time working on their mobility, working on their squat mechanics. Then additionally, ligamentous changes. So this is pretty significant and has great implications for some of the diagnoses that you'll see. When children are born, they have high levels of type 3 collagen, which is very loose, it's very supple, it's mobile. That's why most of your kids, if you take an ACL test, a Wachmann's exam on a 5-year-old, is going to be drastically different from an intact 16-year-old, because their ligamentous laxity is very different. They have a lot of type 3 collagen. And then as they age, as you mature, it transitions to more type 1 collagen, which is stiffer, it has a firmer end feel. And that's why you're also going to see range of motion changes. So if you do a hip exam in a pediatric patient who's 7-8 years old, they're going to have a tremendous amount of hip rotation. But as they age, that hip rotation starts to decrease, both because the ligaments get tighter and because the collagen fibers of their hip joint itself start to ossify a little bit more. So their motion is going to decrease. So that also has implications for some of the pathologies that you'll see. And finally, the social and emotional changes. So I think this is sometimes overlooked with the pediatric and adolescent population, as to what an impact it can have when they have an injury. So for us, we all have jobs, we have families, we have friends. These are what define our self-identity. But for a kid, they're still figuring out who they are, and they don't have as much past to define who they are. They're still trying to find that definition. So these youth athletes are in a life stage with a tremendous amount of change as they learn at it. And sports and school provide a great deal of self-definition and can be a significant source of self-confidence. So when a young athlete can't participate, it would feel the same to them as it would to us if we lost our job, or if all of a sudden our family moved away and we didn't have them anymore. So it's just a perspective to keep in mind as we talk about some of these pathologies and as we're trying to keep kids on the field. As much as you can, try to keep them a part of the team and a part of the friends and the things that they've been doing, because it really does change how they perceive themselves and their own self-worth and identity. All right, so we're going to go through a series of three different buckets of diagnoses. The first is going to be avulsion fractures, the next is going to be apophysitis, and then the final is instabilities. So these are things you're going to see a lot in our adolescent population, and is a direct reflection of those physiological changes we just talked about. A quick anatomy refresher, so you'll see up here on the screen. You've got an open growth plate, and then you also have the apophysis. So the growth plate there, yes. Okay, so right there, that's your growth plate. So that's the site of long bone growth. So that's going to be in your tibia, your femur, your long bones, and that's where their height comes from. And then you also have an apophysis right there. So that right now we're looking at a tibia, so that's your tubercle. And the apophysis is a site of attachment point of a ligament or a tendon. And those are also weak points because the bone has not fully ossified. And so you'll see that in a couple of images coming up. So these are places where you're gonna see weaknesses and see pathology manifest itself. All right, so a couple of common sites of avulsion fractures. The most common is gonna be on the pelvis. And I'm gonna go ahead and flip to this and we'll come back to this screen. So up here, you see some of the incidences from the studies that shows how free pelvic. If you're going to look at a pelvic avulsion fracture, this is where they're most common. So the ASIS, that's the attachment point of your sartorius, your AIIS, which is the attachment point of your rectus, and then your ISH2, so that's the attachment point of your hamstrings. So these are the most common spots that you're going to have an iliac avulsion fracture. Then there's also the medial epicondyle, so your elbow, that's the attachment point of your UCL and the common flexor pronator mass. And then finally, there's also a tibial spine fracture. And I'm just covering kind of the ones we most commonly see. There are others that are found. So the tibial spine fracture is the insertion point of the ACL on the tibia. These avulsion fractures are the ones that you're going to see when they are going through maturation, their growth plates have not closed, their bones are still ossifying, and they have not fully mineralized. So at this point, their ligaments are stronger than their bones. So what would be in an adult patient would be a hip flexor pull, a quad pull, would be an ACL tear. That's when you're going to see avulsion fractures instead with the pediatric population. Identification of these, they're going to be fairly acute onset, as opposed to what we're going to talk about apophysitis in just a moment. Apophysitis tends to be more gradual. They can kind of win, then it gets better and it presents with pain later. An avulsion fracture is going to be acute. They're going to have sudden pain, inability to weight bear or continue throwing, depending upon the pathology. And they're also going to have pain if it's on the iliac crest. They're going to have pain with passive stretch or active contraction. And then if it's in the knee, if it's a tibial spine fracture, they may not be able to achieve full passive knee extension. They might be locked in a little bit of flexion. In the knee, you're going to see a general amount of effusion. It's going to look like they tore a ligament. They might also have a positive Lachman's, depending upon if it's fully avulsed or not. And then in the elbow, they will have positive valgus stress testing, and they may also have some ecchymosis and some swelling as well. All right, so back to the slides. We already talked about the iliac crest fractures. This right there, so this is one thing to keep in mind when you look at images for the first time. If you've never looked at a pediatric image, you're going to see things that look like fractures, but those are just open growth plates. Right, so right here, let's actually look at one. So this has been healed. That looks like a fracture. That's just a growth plate, okay? And then if we come over here, you can see where the white has just right there. So that is more of an apophysitis. It's getting ready to avulse. So if this kid can continue to come with the mechanics with which he had before. And then here, this is a tibial spine fracture. That ossicle you see right there is the attachment point of the ACL, which has avulse off. Treatments for these pathologies is dependent upon the amount of retraction of the bony ossicle. So in a hip, there's a wide amount of variability depending upon surgeon preference, patient presentation, past history, how close they are to bony ossification and union. I've seen anything from 5 millimeter retraction up to 15 millimeter retraction as your line with which they need to get a surgical fixation of the bone. If they don't, they're going to be non-weight bearing for anywhere between 3 to 6 weeks. Again, in the hip, there's a lot amount of variability, but they'll be non-weight bearing or partial weight bearing on crutches for 3 to 6 weeks, and then a progressive return to sport within the next 3 months. For an elbow, they're likely, if you go conservative, then they're going to be locked at 90 degrees of elbow flexion for about 3 to 6 weeks, and then they'll progressive return to sport. Again, similar time frame. We're really just waiting for the bones to heal. If they do, for the elbow, 5 millimeter retraction is the barrier for surgical fixation when they really do need to get that surgically fixed. And then tibial spine, we're seeing a few shifts there. So it used to be more of a wait and see. Let's see how kids do. Let's see if they can just go back to their sports. And then maybe it'll, if it's partially able, so they usually won't do surgery. But if it's fully, they used to wait and see. Now with the progression of physio sparing ACL reconstructions and how good our techniques are getting, a lot of surgeons are starting to opt more for surgical fixation earlier in order to prevent future meniscal pathology as you're waiting for their bone, for their growth plates to close. So again, very highly dependent on surgeon preference and patient presentation, but we'll leave that up to the docs to decide, and then we can rehab as needed. But usually their return, again, an ACL tear, right, that's 9 to 12 months before adult. For a tibial spine fracture, it's closer to 3 to 4 months. If they go in, they fix it, and then they're done, because you're just waiting for the bone to heal. So your early acute care is going to be just like as if they had an ACL tear, a UCL tear, or a hip flexor tear. But because you're not waiting for soft tissue, you're just waiting for bone. So you progress a lot faster because bones just heal a lot faster. All right, so apophysitis, you're going to see a lot of these in both the clinic and in the training room. This is probably the most common pediatric diagnosis that you will encounter as a clinician. The big ones I've listed up here, again, there are other ones, but the most common, obviously, would be your Osgood-Schlatter. So that is the attachment point right here on the tibial tubercle of your patellar tendon. Similar but much less common is Sindig-Larsson-Johansson, or SLJ. And that's going to be up at the distal patellar pole. And that's, again, the attachment of tendon. Similar mechanism of pathology for both of those, because they're both attached to the quad and the patellar tendon. Then little league elbow is going to be your attachment point of the UCL and the common flexor pronator mass again. And that's going to be on the medial epicondyle. Right there, that guy. So what starts off as an apophysitis, if left untreated, hypothetically could progress into an avulsion fracture. We don't really see that play out much. It's not very common for someone to progress from apophysitis to avulsion, but it's just something to keep in mind. It's a bony lesion. So if totally ignored, it could go in that route. And then finally, little league shoulder is not the same as an apophysitis. It's actually an epiphysiolysis. So it's just a separation of the growth plate. Whereas the first four that we talked about, these are all at an apophysis, which is an attachment point of a ligament and tendon. Little league shoulder is actually a separation of the shoulder growth plate, which you can see here. So right there is a widening of the growth plate in the shoulder. So presentation for these kids, you're gonna see with Osgood-Schlatter or SLJ, they're gonna have pain at the site of tendon insertion, and that's pretty common with all of your apophysis. With SLJ and with Osgood, they'll have tenderness there. Severs is the attachment point of the Achilles tendon. They'll have pain with palpation along the calcaneus. With your little league elbow, with little league elbow, they'll have pain on the medial epicondyle, and little league shoulder, they're going to have pain on the proximal humerus. They also, with your lower extremity apophysitis, they're going to have pain usually with squatting, jumping, eccentric activities, with severs, especially if they're running a lot on hard surfaces. So if you have kids in cleats who are running on really hard Texas dirt that hasn't gotten rain for a few months, that's when it's going to kind of flare up. And then with your little league shoulder, it's usually going to be little league shoulder and elbow are often overuse injuries, as honestly all of these are. But specifically, little league elbow and shoulder are likely due to ignoring pitch counts, poor throwing mechanics, excessive torque at the elbow or at the shoulder, depending upon how they're pitching. Treatment for these guys is going to be relative rest. You don't have to completely rest them like you would an avulsion fracture. You can play through it a little bit and kind of see how they do. Ultimately, we're waiting for the growth plates to close, but there are things you can do for pain management in the meantime. Tendon loading, which has become kind of the treatment of choice for tendinopathies, is not quite as effective with this population. So if you're going to be tendon loading for patellar tendonitis, if the patient has or your athlete has some tendinopathy component, it might help a little bit. But ultimately, this isn't a tendon pathology, it's a bone pathology, and it's a pulling away of the apophysis. So it's worth a shot. See if it decreases their pain some. But ultimately, it's really more of a bony issue than it is a tendinop. Like I said, modalities can help with pain, all the stuff that Kevin talked about, and anything else you would usually use in the training room. Give it a shot. See if that helps them feel better. They can play through it as much as they can tolerate. But if they really start to have pain that is progressive and getting worse, rest is ultimately the thing that's going to make them feel the best. Try to keep them active, like we talked about at the beginning. Try to keep them part of the team. Keep their cardio strong. Work on other body parts that aren't typically addressed during their sport. Keep them going, but they likely need to rest from the specific pain generator that they're complaining of. All right, so our last bucket is going to be instability. So as we talked about, these are relatively common in the pediatric and adolescent population because of their genetic laxity. They have a lot more type 3 collagen, which is supple, it's pliable, it's elastic. And then as you go through, you get stiffer because it transitions to type 1 collagen. Instability complaints, there are a lot of categories, but I'm going to talk about them today. There's multidirectional atraumatic, and then there's also unidirectional traumatic. So we'll talk about the shoulder, the knee, and the low back. All right, so shoulder multidirectional instability, they're going to complain of, like, their shoulder feels like it's going to slip out, sort of a general, there's no specific, they can't take a finger and point on one spot, which as a pediatric tip, if you're trying to get them to explain pain, isolate them to one finger and tell them, you have this finger, tell me where it hurts. They're terrible historians. They have no ability to really follow a time frame, so that helps. So with some of these multidirectional instabilities, they're not, even with one finger, they're not really, they're going to point all over it. Same thing at the knee. They're going to kind of point all over their knee and say, well, just the whole thing hurts and it shifts and it moves around. If they have this shifting pain pattern, it's likely just instability. Treatment for multidirectional instability is just going to be general cuff and scapular endurance and strengthening. Again, if they have not yet hit skeletal maturity, you're not working on muscular hypertrophy, you're doing a lot of muscular endurance and you're working on technique. Shoulder dislocations, if they're really young, you're less likely to see any kind of bony deformity because of it. You're not going to see a Bankart lesion. They're just going to pop out and then pop back in. But that is unidirectional. They do get some stretching of ligaments. Treatment ultimately is going to be the same as it is for a multidirectional instability. You're just going to protect them from a few range of motions. You're not going to let them go back behind their back and keep them in what would be like a diamond zone of safety. So they're here in the front for probably the first 4 to 6 weeks. Let their ligaments scar down, tighten down, and you can progress pretty quick from there. Then with the knee, patellofemoral pain syndrome, which is this big umbrella diagnosis, and it's ambiguous and there's no real pain generator. So again, like I just mentioned, this is going to be where they don't have a specific pain spot. They kind of point around the whole kneecap, and one day it hurts at the bottom, one day it hurts at the top, one day on the inside, then the outside. They don't have any swelling, no other ligamentous laxity. Their clinical exam is negative. That's going to fall into your patellofemoral pain bucket. And these kids do really well with just general strengthening. You can classify them. There are a couple of different classifications. It can be general hypermobility. It can also be asymmetrical muscle tension. So do your clinical exam, see what's tight, see what's weak, address those causative factors. And then it can also be due to alignment. So if they have weak hips or femoral antiversion or flat feet, that's going to drop their knees in and it's going to create excessive tension on the patella. So address all those things, get better shoes, strengthen their hips. They'll complain why they're strengthening their hips when their knee hurts, but just try to give them a broad perspective, long-term gain. And then for patellar dislocation. So these can be both traumatic and atraumatic. your traumatic patellar dislocations are much less likely to be recurrent because they were not predisposed to in the first place. So they often tear their MPFL or have a bony deficit afterwards. The decision with regards to surgery on these patients is based off of their amount of felt instability. They'll usually, unless they have a bony avulsion or a loose fragment inside the knee, they'll usually try conservative management first before they'll go in with surgery. So treatment for these guys is going to be a lot of strengthening. Again, clinical exam, address what's tight, address what's weak, try to correct alignment issues. And then you can try bracing. In my experience, bracing is very hit or miss. Like Kevin said, placebos are real things. So if they feel like their brace is helping, great, wear it. Wear it all the time, whenever you want to. You can get a patellar buttress brace, one that's going to kind of give them patellar stability medially. You can also try McConnell taping. Again, evidence doesn't totally back that up, but patient report often says they feel better with it. So you can try McConnell taping, you can try K-tape, you can try a lot of different things. So worth a shot, but they typically haven't been shown to make a huge difference. Let's see. All right. So last topic here is going to be low back pain. With kids, it's not very common with our youngest athletes to see low back pain. So if you see someone who's 12, 11 and younger with low back pain, that should throw up a couple of red flags. Now, if you have a 16-year-old who looks fully mature and he's a lineman and he has back pain, okay, yes, that I would expect that. Or if you have a band athlete who has never done a sport in their life and is carrying a 60-pound drum and has to march for 8 hours a day as they're getting ready for the season, yes, you're going to have back pain. That makes sense. So your general low back pain can be caused by microinstability, strength and muscle tension asymmetries, and also by posture. So address all those things when you're making a rehab diagnosis and when you're telling them what to work on. Also do a movement analysis. So if you have a pitcher who has low back pain, check out his technique, see how he's moving, see if he's relying too much on his low back to get momentum and to get torque. If you have a lacrosse player, again, same thing. If he has pain when he shoots, okay, look at how he's shooting. See if he lacks core strength and he's relying more on his ligaments to kind of carry him through. And then finally, spondylolysis and spondylolisthesis. So you're not going to see many of these, but I think it's important to mention because they do need to be handled appropriately. So spondylolysis is a weakening of the pars interarticularis without displacement. And then the spondylolysis, which is right there, is when you actually get anterior displacement of the superior vertebra and you get a fracture line on the pars. If they just have spondylolysis, just a stress reaction, which has to be seen on MRI, then they can be treated conservatively, hold off on sports, strengthen core. You're going to likely go through a Pilates or flexion-based program of strengthening. You don't want to put them in a bird dog position, no reverse hypers or hyperextensions, because that's their mechanism of injury. If they do actually have a fracture, if they have spondylolisthesis, typically they're going to be braced. They're going to put in a Boston brace or a TLSO. It's a total bummer, especially in Houston summers, for like 6 months. And then they'll be released to start going back in. Likely they'll be sent to rehab at 4 to 6 weeks after they've been put in the brace, but they're out for a while. And it's a bummer. The athletes that you're gonna see this most commonly in to kind of be aware of is gonna obviously be your gymnasts. That's probably the most common. Dancers, weightlifters, your throwers, so pitchers, and then also linemen. So anything that requires repeated excessive hyperextension, especially under loads. So a couple of take-home points, and so these would be recommendations that y'all could give to your pediatric adolescent athletes. Do what you love. So it's important that they're not investing all this time in a sport that they really don't care that much about. So do what you like to do because you're going to be better at it, you're going to work harder at it, and you're going to care about it. Practice good technique when you're young. So when they're, like we talked about, when they're really young, get squat mechanics down, get a push-up down. Get their basics down so that then when they're ready to actually hit the training room and get more muscular hypertrophy, they have all the technique there and then you don't have to worry about them. Stay globally strong, be diverse. So I know we've talked a little, there's just the general idea of sports specialization and whether this is a good or a bad thing. Generally, I think as healthcare practitioners, we would prefer our patients and athletes not to specialize until they hit puberty because it's important to stay globally strong. And that's gonna not only prevent injury, it's gonna make them a stronger athlete. Strengthen the skills and muscles that are not emphasized in your primary sport. So again, that talks about diversity, non-specialization until you're farther. And then finally, take personal responsibility for your health and game time readiness. No one knows you better than it's up to you for your hard work. These kids, again, are in an emotional and psychological transition phase. And so it's important to help them through into adulthood to understand that this is your knee. This is your shoulder. It's not my job to make you better. I give you tools. But just like a class, just like you have homework, you have things that you need to do to help make yourself better. And ultimately, it's going to be to your benefit to work on these things. It's not your mom and dad's job. It's your job. So try to establish a little bit of personal responsibility, because one, that makes them better, and two, it does offload you. So you don't have to micromanage this patient or this athlete. And a final point is that we're not just their physical coaches, but also a little bit of a life coach in a time when they're developing skills and character traits that are going to go with them for the rest of their lives. So we have a huge opportunity with our pediatric and adolescent patients and athletes to really impact them for the long haul, make them love sports, make them love workouts, make them love being healthy and active, and also learning how to take personal responsibility for their health and wellness.